Good to see each one this evening. We would remind you of the question period that will follow, hopefully along with some answers. And if you have some questions, some ideas that challenge, we'd be glad to see if we can respond. The subject of the age of the earth, I think, is one of the more critical issues when we're dealing with the concept of creation. If the earth is billions of years old, it's kind of hard to imagine it ending next Thursday. The imminent end, the sharp edge of accountability that comes with a judgment that's threatening perhaps today, presents a very different worldview. If it's been here for billions of years, you don't worry much about that. And of course, if the earth is young, you don't have time. It takes billions of years for evolution, even according to the evolutionist. But it stiff arms the idea of an imminent creation if you have billions of years. And I think it has a tremendous impact. There are a great many scientists, of course, who believe that the earth is billions of years old. It's necessary for their faith. It's essential. That is faith in evolution, naturalism. And to give an idea of the role that the age of the earth plays in the thinking of the evolutionist, notice the statement by George Wald, who's a Nobel laureate. He's a microbiologist, and he's talking about the complexity of life, some of the things that we brought out earlier this week, the tremendous amount of information that has to function together in a coordinated fashion. He said one only has to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Well, that should end the matter, shouldn't it? No, that's only if you're going by the facts. Yet, here we are, I believe, as a result of spontaneous generation. It's impossible, but he believes it. And they have no problem doing that. He continues, however improbable we regard this event or any of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. So this is his solution to the impossible problem. Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, the probable virtually certain. One only has to wait, and time itself performs the miracles. And so this is the Holy Spirit of the evolutionist. Wave the magic wand of time, and all the problems go away. I don't think time has that capacity. If you were here last night, you would perhaps more readily understand why. With time, things go uphill or they go downhill. Some of us can tell you firsthand that with time, it doesn't go uphill. And most of us understand that. It's imagination that asserts that it goes the other way. Most of us are familiar with the fairy tale where the princess kisses the frog and boom, there's the prince. And we understand that's a fairy tale. Unless you add the magic kiss of time, and then it's science, and that's what's taught. We're spending billions of dollars to teach that in our universities. Given enough time, that frog will turn into a prince. No, I don't think time has that capacity at all. When we're talking about the age of the earth, we're just told this over and over, usually without any argumentation. It's billions of years. I like to ask why questions. I think those are good beginning points, especially in science. You believe this. Why do you believe that? And when we ask why regarding the age of the earth, usually the first response that we get involves radiometric dating, because they've dated rocks and they're billions of years old, so obviously the earth has to be at least that old. and that sounds reasonable. And of course, everybody understands how the radiometric dating systems work, right? I mean, we all understand that? No. And the scientists don't either, usually. Of course, the chronologists specialize in it, but many of the geologists and archaeologists have no expertise in that field at all. And we won't try to make you an expert in the field this evening, but in a very general way, let's describe how it works. It begins with atoms that are complex, heavy, and are not stable, and they degenerate. And that's somewhat oversimplifying. They emit alpha or beta particles from the nucleus of the atom, and that decay process, decaying into a series of different elements, tells time something like an hourglass. Now, that's not a perfect analogy, but it helps illustrate the concept. You begin with uranium-238, for example, which is radioactive. It decays by emitting particles through a series of elements, finally winding up as lead-206. So it loses from 236 down to 206, 32 particles in the process. Four each become helium atoms, so you have 8 atoms of helium as a result of the decay process. But this tells time, if we know the rate, of course, of decay, like the hourglass, and you use this formula, which we won't try to explain, but that's the way you get the supposedly precise answers. What kind of problems could there be with this kind of a time-telling mechanism? How much time, let's assume that we're looking at an hourglass, how much time has transpired as you look at that? And you might conclude, well, maybe 15, 20 minutes of the hour's worth of sand has gone down to the bottom. But suppose just before you were asked the question, somebody raised the lid and dumped in a lot of extra sand such that most of it had already hit the bottom, and you now then it's skewed by adding more at the top. That would completely foul up the conclusion, wouldn't it? Or suppose somebody lowered the base and let out most of what had already run down there. Or suppose it was laying on its side basically like this, and 12 seconds earlier they stood it up, and you say 12 minutes, and it looks like 12 minutes, but it's 12 seconds. You don't know the beginning conditions. You can't tell the time. These are the problems that are acknowledged to be involved in the decay processes. Henry Fall, who's chairman of the Department of Geology at the University of Pennsylvania and an authority in this field, says there are two important assumptions implicit in this equation, the one we looked at the bottom. First, that we're dealing with a closed system. In other words, nothing leaked in, nothing leaked out. Unless that's the case, you can't tell time. Second, that no atoms of the daughter, that's what's produced at the bottom, were present in the system when it formed. How did it start? Did you have a lot at the bottom to start with? We don't know. These assumptions furnish the most serious limitations on the accumulation clock. Now, he believes in it, he uses it, but he understands there are significant problems. He says rigorously closed systems probably do not exist in nature. Okay, you've got to have a closed system to have a dependable conclusion, but closed systems don't exist in nature, according to his acknowledgement. We understand that when we look at the process of fossilization. You begin with a shell. That's basically calcium carbonate. Water percolates through, leaches out certain materials, adds other materials. It may wind up as metal, pyrite, fossilized. How did that happen? Well, this leaked in and this leaked out. It's not a closed system. And with that kind of thing going on, you're not going to be able to tell time, as he acknowledges. Closed systems don't exist. He does go on to say, surprisingly, many minerals and rocks satisfy the requirement well enough for nuclear age determination. The problem is one of judicious geologic selection. you judiciously select the one that gives you the, quote, right answer that you assume before you start. If it's the wrong answer, well, that must be contaminated. Something leaked in and leaked, and you toss it. Now, that may sound cynical, but that is exactly what we see happening and consistently. Let me give you an example from the evolutionists themselves. Richard Leakey found the 1470 skull, which has become significant in the philosophy of the evolution of man that we'll talk about, Lord willing, Friday night. How old is it? Well, that's the whole ball game. It doesn't mean anything if it's fairly recent. You've got to be the right age in order to say the right thing. And so they're dating this, and his friend Roger Lewin is writing this book. They've written several books together. He says the calculated age was quickly refined to be 2.61 plus or minus 0.26 million years, which to anthropologists unfamiliar with the procedures of radiometric dating, many of them are unfamiliar, but to those unfamiliar, it has a ring of comforting precision. To those who are familiar, they know better. But it sounds very precise, 2.61 plus or minus 0.26 million years. He goes on to say why those familiar with it are not so confident. He said there were 41 separate age determinations. This fellow did a lot of dating. 41 different times they dated it, which varied between 223 million and 0.91 million. Now that is a huge range. From 223 down to less than one, it's all over the place. And so precisely, you say, he says, after the first determination, they never again obtained 2.61. And so those familiar with what's going on behind the scenes, that you have tossed 40 in order to get the one, don't have as much confidence. If you're unfamiliar with it, you buy what they're selling, but otherwise you're pretty suspicious. We can see times where we can test under circumstances where we know the answer so that we can see if it works. Now that's kind of not playing fair. Usually they want it where you don't know the answer. When I was in school, if I had to have the answer before the test, then, well, they wouldn't let me do that. But if you submit a form for a sample, you want somebody to test it at the lab, they will have you fill out on that form how old you think it is, or they won't do the test. Now, that's just the way it works. You can try that if you want to. We have. But here at Mount St. Helens, we have rock in the middle of this caldera that was extruded since 1980 when it erupted. That actually was several years afterward, I think 86, when that particular section was extruded, and so we know the origin. We sent that to the radiocarbon dating lab, as well as potassium argon. In fact, that's, I think, the one that they depended on. And five samples were taken. The result was, of this 11-year-old rock, millions of years. We had five samples. One of them was about 500,000. The other was almost 3 million, and it was 11 years old. With potassium argon, the argon decays. The argon is a decay product of the potassium. And the assumption is that if it is lava, then it is completely reset so that all of the gas escapes, the byproduct of the decay, which is what they're measuring to determine the age. Well, it didn't all escape, obviously. It's still quite a bit there and varying amounts of it, so it doesn't work. And we can demonstrate that, but that's still used consistently. Radiocarbon dating is what we normally hear about. It's usually, are often used to refer to all the processes, but it actually refers to a process that is very convenient for archaeologists. It covers a much shorter range than what would be interesting for most evolutionists, but it's one we hear about. It's detectable only for tens of thousands of years. All of it would be gone 40, 50, 60,000 years, and so it doesn't go beyond that. The millions of years would be other systems. But if we have something 50,000 years old, I think we have a serious challenge to what we read in the Bible. Robert Lee, in the Anthropological Journal of Canada, is talking about the fundamental problems here. He said, it should be no surprise then that fully half of the dates are rejected. And I think that's very conservative. I know it is. The wonder is surely that the remaining half come out to be accepted. There are gross discrepancies. The chronology is uneven and relative. And the accepted dates are actually selected dates. So this is not an objective process. You take it and date it. Okay, here's the date. That's not an accurate picture. You pick the one you want. I have a friend who runs the Carbon 14 lab at Ball State University. I was visiting a few years ago. And he was dating a peat bog, which he was sure was at least 19,000 years old. But all of the dates had come back 3 and 4, which in his mind proves that it was contaminated, and he's continuing to do it. He'd done it 19 times. He was on the 20th. He says, we're going to get a good one yet. But the first 19 are in the trash can because it didn't come out right. Now, this is not science. This is a game that's played to confirm what you have already concluded. But it's not the impression that we get from that. I think one of the most important projects of late has been the RATE project, which was conducted by highly qualified scientists who are creationists to test some of these processes. And one of the ways to do it is to date dinosaur fossils with carbon 14. Now, the normal scientist would say, wait a minute, these are 65 million years old at least, the dinosaurs, and this doesn't go beyond 50,000. And so you wouldn't do that. Okay, it'd all be gone within 50,000, but let's try it and see. No, we don't want to do that. And they strongly resist, but we did. We dated over 100 dinosaur fossils with carbon-14. All of them had significant amounts of carbon-14, as well as samples of coal and diamond, which are carbon and are supposed to be millions of years old. All the carbon-14 would be gone in less than 50,000, and all of them should have no carbon-14 if they're as old as they say they are. But the truth is, with this RATE project, every one of the samples had significant amounts, hundreds of times above the background level, of carbon-14, which wasn't supposed to be there. And so I think we have a significant demonstration that many of these things supposed to be millions of years old are not. They're thousands. That's our conclusion based on what the facts demonstrate. And it's very friendly to our position, which is that they're thousands, not millions. And so radiocarbon's not always contradictory. Sometimes I think very helpful if they look at the evidence. But when we look at the so-called absolute dating assumptions, first, that you have a closed system and you don't know that. You don't know the beginning conditions. There's some lead that occurs naturally, some that occurs radiogenically. How much? Well, you have to guess at that. There are various ways to do that, but it's a guess, and that determines the conclusion. You have to know that the rate is constant, and we don't know that. It's related to the speed of light, which is another issue. But with the inflation concepts trying to explain the problems with the Big Bang, some have proposed it went 10 to the 70th time faster in the past. If the rate's not constant, then of course we've got a clock that doesn't tell time. It runs fast sometimes, slow other times. We see known ages contradicting with the caldera at Mount St. Helens, with the old things that are not old. These are significant problems, and we're not talking about Genesis. We're talking about scientific problems that are real, with the idea that this is dating and telling us exactly what the time is. Having pointed these things out, W.D. Stanfield, who is an anti-creationist, vicious professor of biological science, California Polytechnic State University, acknowledged, it's obvious that radiometric techniques may not be the absolute dating methods they're claimed to be. And then says there is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock. And I think he's right. It's amazing that he would make such an admission, but I think he was forced to. So when we look at how it works, it's a game to conclude what's already been concluded, to confirm assumptions. I don't think that's a threat to our concept of a young Earth. In fact, sometimes it directly supports our concept of a young Earth. Now, radiometric dating then is not a real good answer to the question of why. So now, why do you think the Earth's old? The next response usually involves the geologic phenomenon. The layers, millions of layers, all of the fossils, the coal, oil, these things take millions of years, and it just looks old. Well, when you know how these things form, I don't think it looks old at all. I think it looks flooded. I think that's the more reasonable conclusion, and I'll show you why. Beginning with an interesting article in the New York Times just a few years ago regarding what they're seeing on Mars, sedimentary layers. Well, what does that mean? Horizontal layers, usually laid down by water, is what we're seeing at. Well, there's no water on Mars, or virtually not. Lots of water on Earth. But what they say about this is there's signs of great floods on Mars. And the signs, he says, they're recognizing the awesome magnitude of a deluge that swept over much of the... There's no water up there, virtually. But look at the layers. This says there must have been a deluge over much of the red planet, a catastrophe that perhaps only Noah could appreciate. Well, yeah, that's what it looks like because we see these horizontal layers, even though there's no water up there. But on Earth, where there's plenty of water, there are plenty of horizontal layers. We've got sedimentary layers covering the continents, to an average depth of 1.5 miles all over the world. And no, there's no flood here. We got to explain that differently, even though we got 70% of the surface covered by water, an average of about 3 miles deep. But they refuse to see a flood because of the implications. It would sound too much like what you read about in the Bible, and so they avoid that by saying, no, it's done over millions of years. Now, it looks just like what they're seeing on Mars that means flood. I think that's amazing. But that gets them a slow, gradual process if they assume this gradually built up over millions of years. Well, they're just impossible problems with that. But this is their conclusion. Here in the Great Dinosaur Extinction, Officer and Drake say that a rate of 1 centimeter per 1,000 years is typical. Okay, that's the idea. You got less than half an inch per 1,000 years, and so you got thousands of years with the mile that you see revealed at Grand Canyon. Is this a possible explanation? Could be a flood deposit, or it could be just gradually built up over millions of years. Well, when you look at the rocks themselves, I see one of the two explanations just obviously substantiated, the other completely refuted. Dunbar and Rogers, that I studied from two different state universities, principles of stratigraphy, study of the strata, say some thoughtful stratigrapher to some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery, that is billions of years, presented a dilemma. Now, many would think, you look at the rocks and now that says old, but he says, no, you look at the rocks and try to say old and it's a problem. For if the known stratified rocks have been accumulating throughout this vast span of time, the average rate of deposition must have been extremely slow. Now, half an inch, 1,000 years. Yet there is very good evidence that individual beds accumulated rapidly, which you don't hear about in your earth science textbook. What's he talking about? Good evidence, when you look at the individual beds, that it happened rapidly. Well, you look at the fossils in these individual beds and think. Now, that won't hurt. Let's try it. How long did it take these rocks to form? What's going to happen to the shrimp if it takes 1,000 years to form half an inch? Is that shrimp going to sit there and look like this over thousands of years while it gradually has a rock grow around it? You ladies know you can put the shrimp in the refrigerator and it'll just last for years and years and years. I see big, broad smiles all over the place. We know, but what's going to happen to the shrimp that dies and lays out there on the beach for a couple of days? Not going to look like this. How long did it take the rock to form? Think about it. That rock had to form rapidly, which is what Dunbar and Rogers are saying. You look at fossils like this, and we've got several of them out there at the museum, where the fish are in the process of eating their supper, and they got caught eating their supper, and the rock formed while they were eating their supper, and beautifully preserved here. Now, I enjoy eating with my brethren from time to time, and some folk are just kind of slow when they're trying to consume their meal, but, you know, 100,000 years is ridiculous. These are beautiful fossils that say rapid cannot be otherwise if we just stop and think about it. And some of the things that have been developing is just almost like God's providing this to make fun of them. This was earlier this year. A school of fish captured in a fossil. Now, they're still in formation. And this formed at the rate of half an inch per 1,000 years. Just think about this. This section out here in the square is 10 millimeters. That's enlarged there in the section. That's the same as the 1 centimeter that was described by Officer and Drake that said took 1,000 years. So what you're looking at in that square is 1,000 years in order to form. And they're still part of that formation, and the fish are beautifully preserved in the formation. That's just nuts to think that happened slow. Just insanity involves just denying reality. Roy Palnick, paleontologist, University of Illinois, commented on that this year, the next month, in the New York Times, and made an interesting statement. He said, I can't picture a three-dimensional school of fish sinking to the bottom, maintaining their relative positions. That makes no sense to me. Well, good for him. At least somebody's willing to say the emperor is naked here. This is not going to fit an old age. How do you do that slowly? It just is not possible. It's impossible. Reminds me of the passage in Alice in Wonderland where Alice says, there's no use trying. She said, one can't believe impossible things. And the Red Queen says, I dare say you haven't had much practice, said the Queen. When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. You know, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. And paleontologists have learned that lesson. It's impossible makes no sense, but they believe it anyway. And he continues to believe in the billions of years and slow, gradual processes that does not fit what we see. We see fossils like this. This particular section is over 12 feet, and it actually extends beyond that. It's a fossil fern, Lepidodendron, up in the Cumberland Mountains above Knoxville, Tennessee. Coal seam down at the bottom, another coal seam at the top with hundreds of layers in between. Half an inch, 1,000 years. Another half an inch, 1,000 years. What's going to happen to the top of that fern? I've been there several times. This is the main fern, but there's several of them in the area. This one's 12 feet exposed. I'm sitting on the coal seam. But backing up, you see, actually, there are several of these fossil ferns that are exposed. They were digging down to the coal seam in a coal mine and exposed these fossil ferns. Now, how do you account for that? 1,000 years per half inch. That's just crazy. I think there is a much better explanation. I think there was one catastrophic event that buried it, and it's a flood deposit. That also preserved the fossil leaves, the little fronds here. This is beautifully preserved, as I believe you can see. That fern has not wilted. Can you imagine that forming at half an inch per 1,000 years? Half an inch wouldn't get that covered, and I think a day that thing is going to wilt. How long does it take a fern to wilt? And this is in coal, which is supposed to take millions of years, but obviously could not with what we see in the coal. Some of the fern fossils we see bent over like we see staged there at the bottom, and it's formed into hard rock before it had time to spring back. When we know how long it takes for ferns to wilt, you can sit there and watch them wilt sometimes. We see the problem that they have trying to say this is slow. And what Schuster's talking about when he says there's very good evidence that it formed rapidly. Science Daily is talking about some of these ferns and says the preservation happened so quickly that some of the cells have even been preserved during different stages of cell division. Found nuclei, membranes, even individual chromosomes happening at the rate of half an inch per 1,000 years. It just defies explanation. Now, coal had to form rapidly per the circumstance we just looked at. What about oil? Same thing we find. This is a publication from the U.S. Department of Energy. Rapid oil was the heading of the article. Algae turned into crude oil takes minutes in the lab. Recently reported in the journal Algae Research, out comes crude oil over millions of years. No, less than an hour. In fact, the experiment had been going on for about 4 years before they found out it wouldn't work unless they did it fast. And then they got it to work. But here is the publication. Now, oil does not take a long time. In fact, they found it didn't work if they took a long time. Some of the fossils just dramatically make the point. This is an ichthyosaur. This one is 28 feet long. There's one recently found in England, 85 feet long. But it's perfectly intact from one end to the other, from top to bottom, not forming at the rate of half an inch per 1,000 years. In fact, the top part here is adipose tissue. That's fatty tissue, and it's beautifully preserved. And amazingly, you look at the abdomen, and you see this is a mama ichthyosaur with the embryo inside. They gave live birth, and with dramatic, perhaps a storm, traumatic circumstance, they would give premature birth, and there are dozens of them that are seen in the process of giving premature birth frozen in the limestone. Now, these are not little bitty, these are great big fossils. Many, many of the half-inch sections supposed to be 1,000 each. Here is baby ichthyosaur emerging from the birth canal. This is what he's talking about when he says there's very good evidence that it accumulated rapidly, that the rocks formed rapidly, not slowly. And this is not blind faith. This is hard evidence. Recently in PLOS, we have a picture of one of these ichthyosaurs. They describe that they capture the moment of live birth with a baby emerging from the pelvis of the mother. Here's a Kodak moment, not thousands of years. Very good evidence that it's rapid. And I'm sorry, I'm a geologist. I like the fossils. I just like to pile on. More and more evidence is seen. Many of you are familiar with this critter, the jellyfish. I was showing this to a junior high group the other day and asked the question, what are jellyfish made of? And one little girl waved her hand. I know, it's made out of snot. Well, almost. But it's substantial enough to form a fossil over thousands of years. That's just nuts. Some of them are just beautifully preserved. How do you do that slowly? You just can't do that. That's an impossible thing. And they're believing dozens of impossible things. Here the ripple marks likewise are very quickly removed, moving as you watch them. All kinds of evidence that the individual beds accumulated rapidly. Over and over and over again we see this. Even with the formation of fish come swimming in. No, that's a fossil, not fish swimming. In addition, we see obvious instances, like the jellyfish, of soft tissue, which is being talked about here in Fizz.org, especially from the Burgess Shale, in exquisite detail. The question of how this came to happen has troubled science. Well, boy, that's a good sign. Most of them are not troubled at all. They just don't think about it. But this troubled scientists since the discovery of the fossils back in 1909. Now, that's a long time to worry about a problem. They don't talk about it. But if that is a problem, the hard fossil forming from the soft tissue, what about soft tissue that's still soft? That's supposed to be millions of years old. Here we're looking at a cross-section of a T-Rex, and this is a blood vessel with blood cells in it that are still squishy in a T-Rex bone. Now, this was first announced a number of years ago, back 2006, reported here in Discover magazine. Mary Schweitzer had not finished her doctorate at the time, and they didn't. Well, they piled on and ridiculed, and but some looked at it and said, "All right, here's squishy tissue that she's got in the T-Rex bone." She was interviewed in Discover and said, "I had one reviewer tell me I didn't care what the data said." He's telling the truth. He knew that what I was finding wasn't possible, says Schweitzer. I wrote back and said, "Well, what data would convince you?" And he said, "None." And he was telling the truth. You think scientists are objective. Sorry. Doesn't matter what the facts are. They're going to believe what they want to believe. Now, if that's hard to imagine, just recall the last time you tried to show somebody Acts 2:38 and they didn't want to see it. It's exactly the same thing. This is their religion, and they're not willing to turn loose. Not all of them, but many of them refuse. I have talked with Mary Schweitzer on a number of occasions, very interesting person. She's fairly reasonable. She just acknowledges our current theories do not account for soft tissue and cellular preservation, and she's continuing to do research. I think maybe we're making some progress. She published in 2013 the finding of DNA in the dinosaur bones. Now, our DNA is very fragile. It's damaged daily with cosmic radiation. Our bodies are designed, I believe, to repair that, and the repair process is ongoing. And if you don't have that repaired regularly, you're going to be in serious trouble. It degenerates quickly. But antibodies, she says, to DNA now show multiple lines of evidence for consistent with DNA in dinosaurs. When organisms die, we're told here in Discover, Article 2017, their DNA decomposes, and it decomposes quickly. Well, these dinosaurs are supposed to be 65 million years old at least, and they got DNA in them. Some of the articles actually indicated it couldn't last more than 10,000 years, which I think is a very reasonable estimate. But this particular article is trying to wrestle with that, and they did some experiments to see how long it would last. And they said the optimal under optimal conditions, now, in the Hell Creek Formation up there where this was found in Colorado, it's not optimal conditions. It's not almost 0 degrees, which is where this experiment took place. But when it's very, very cold, the DNA could survive for a million years. But in order for it to explain what you're seeing, it's got to be 65 million years. Even under optimal conditions, it won't last more than a million. But here it is, 65 million. More and more impossible things that they're believing. Not tens of millions of years when we're looking at dinosaur bones. Whether we're talking about carbon-14 or we're talking about DNA in the bones, it is proof that we're looking at thousands of years, not millions. And so these things are becoming the creationist trends. So when we're looking at the blood vessels, which she's found, the soft, squishy tissue which stretches and pops back, in dinosaur bones, what you're seeing is clear evidence, including now DNA, that these fossils are not as old as they're telling us they are. In fact, they're not old beyond tens of thousands of years, certainly. So think about it now. The fossils in the layers are not old. And if the fossils in the layers are not old, then wouldn't that say the layers are not old? And if the layers are not old, then looking at this scene doesn't say old. It doesn't look old. I think it looks flooded, as we indicated. And where is the evidence of time? Well, we ask that question from time to time, and sometimes people get pushed and try to respond to it. Today's answer is, well, the time is not in the layers. The layers did happen quickly. We can show that with the jellyfish fossils and the polystrate, the trees going through many layers, the ferns. It's in between the layers. And so each of the layers are rapid, but we're going to put the time in between. And I say, you mean where there is no evidence? Well, actually, that's overstating their case, because there is evidence there, and it's negative to their view. But notice the statement by Derek Eger. He says, we cannot escape the conclusion that sedimentation was at times rapid. And in the context, he's talking about the fossil ferns going through many, many layers. You can't avoid that. At other times, there were long breaks in the sedimentation. And the evidence for that is, well, there had to be if you come up with long periods of time, which he will do. It looks uniform and continuous, but it's not. It just looks that way. It really isn't. And he doesn't believe what it's saying. Notice what he goes on to say. The geological record is constantly lying to us. Now, as a scientist, you're supposed to go with the evidence, right? Here's the facts. Here's your conclusion. No, the facts are lying to you. You don't go that way. It pretends to tell us the whole truth when it's only telling us a small part of it. It may seem to be paradoxical, and amen. But to me, the gaps cover most of Earth history. In other words, I'm going to base my conclusions on what's not there, not what is there. It was during the breaks that most events probably occurred. It's the gaps, the lack, the absence of it that really matters. Can you believe that? This is supposed to be a scientist. We look at the breaks, supposedly, and here is a prime example. The Coconino sandstone down near the bottom of Grand Canyon is on top of the Hermit Shale, and it's supposed to be 110 million years later, according to their dating of the fossils in those rocks. But in between, you've got straight, level, knife-edge break where he puts and has to put 110 million years. Now, when you look at the whole canyon, you've got straight, smooth contact lines from one end to the other that you can trace for 300 miles sometimes. When you have exposure over a period of time, you have erosion. Time produces erosion, and that's not what you see. You see straight, smooth contact lines, one immediately after the other. But they imagine that the time is in there between where the evidence is not there. When you look at the contact lines in between the layers, you see things like fossils of bird tracks, which when they leave fossils in the mud, going to last for millions of years, thousands of years, hundreds of years, be gone the next time it rains. I think this is basically in the concrete, which is same formula as limestone. You see the ephemeral markings like the ripple marks, the raindrop impressions, the animal tracks that say first they had to be like the tracks out here in the sidewalk. Somebody walked there and that had to form quickly in order to preserve the tracks or they'd be gone with the next rain. And then the next layer had to come on top of it in order to keep it from eroding. But when we look at here are the dinosaur tracks down to Glen Rose, Texas, with the ripple marks. In order for that to be preserved, ripple marks will last a day or two. That has to form rapidly. The layers to preserve these marks have to form rapidly. And then if they are formed rapidly and exposed, they erode rapidly. So the next layer has to come on top of it quickly. And then it has a surface that has the same kind of ripple marks that had to be preserved rapidly and then protected from erosion. It's from top to bottom indication it all has to form rapidly. That's the clear indication of such things as ripple marks. That's the most common feature in the sedimentary rocks. In fact, it's been said you follow any bedding plane far enough, you find ripple marks. We've all seen those in the rocks. That says rapid underneath and above. But maybe the most obvious demonstration of this, and here you have to think a little bit with me. Here's the red wall, the Mississippian, almost halfway up the geologic column, on top of the Muav, the Cambrian, which is right down at the bottom, the lowest layer. Well, you're missing at least 150 million years in between the two. Okay, there must have been erosion there for 150 million years. Doesn't look like erosion. It looks straight and level. But look at the interface. You go from the Muav to the red wall and then back to the Muav. Now, wait a minute. The red wall is 150 million years later. So you skip 150 million years because of erosion, but then you go back and get some more Muav, and then you go back and forth and back and forth eight times. How do you skip 150 million years eight times and go back and forth? That's just crazy, one of those impossible things they choose to believe. These interbedded layers, when we were studying stratigraphy,
We were told if the layers are interbedded, they're contemporaneous, which just makes good common sense. Here they are. No, they can't be. They're 150 million years apart. And there's no way to logically explain that. It does look continuous, and I think we can demonstrate that it is. They cannot be millions of years apart and back and forth and back and forth. I think we can prove that. But how do we get all these layers in the first place? How do we accumulate such a huge deposit? Well, I think it's a flood deposit. And we can see the catastrophic formation of this kind of deposit in laboratory conditions, if you please. For example, with what happened at Mount St. Helens, where the top blew 1980, and a huge pyroclastic cloud came roaring across the countryside, depositing what was on the mountain, then across the countryside, about 600 feet of sedimentary layers were blasted across the countryside. And here we see that deposit with Spirit Lake that was dammed up. Finally, the dam broke and eroded right down through the newly laid sediment. And that little bitty trickle down there is what eroded that huge canyon. You buy that? I don't think so. I think it was a lot of water that went through there, and this little trickle is what's left. And maybe you've seen the Grand Canyon and had the same impression. But here we see the laminated layers that were formed rapidly. These layers were formed at 150 miles an hour on May the 18th, 1980. Now, a few of them, some of it late, but within a three-month period maximum, most of it one afternoon. And they're finely laminated, some of them more coarse. But this happened rapidly. We saw it happen. And it left canyons that looked for all the world like the canyons at Grand Canyon. That looked like Grand Canyon? Like this? I'm sorry, that is Grand Canyon. This is Mount St. Helens, and where Spirit Lake broke the dam and eroded through it. Reminds me of the cartoon my friend drew. This million-year-old canyon was formed by Mount St. Helens in 1980. And that makes pretty good sense if you know how they're thinking. We look at formations like the speleotherms, the stalactites, stalagmites in the caves, and we're told this is hundreds of thousands of years. My textbook said it took 100,000 years to form one half or one cubic inch of this material. And so formations like this would take a long time. But they're found under buildings like this. That particular cave that we just looked at near Bloomington, Indiana, has the Bloomington limestone, which you see in the Empire State Building. And here at the George Rogers Clark Memorial on the banks of the Wabash River, a clay bank that provides the side of the river there. And that limestone that was quarried just a few miles from the cave is stacked together here, and the water percolates down through the cracks here just like it does in caves. And in the basement of that building, you see formations just like you find in the caves. There are columns, five of them, 11 feet tall. And finally, they reported it was covered up for a number of years. I was not allowed in for a while. Finally got pressure from the legislature to get in and take pictures. But here they acknowledged stalactites have been growing in the basement of the George Rogers Clark Memorial in Vincennes, Indiana, because of the leak since it opened in 1933. And there's the huge columns. Hundreds of thousands of years. Not so. You go to Carlsbad Caverns and you find some really huge formations that may have taken 1,000 years. But we see bats, of course, flying around through the canyon, and one of them was slow enough to get caught by a stalactite, which must have been a pretty fast stalactite to catch the bat and cover him up before he was able to rot and to decay. which says what about how fast these formations form. This was found out in the desert in an Aurora ditch near Aurora, Texas, which is south of Odessa, and there's nothing south of Odessa, in the middle of nowhere. And it looks like a regular cowboy boot until you look on the inside, and we have petrified bones and petrified flesh around those bones. Looking carefully, you can actually see the petrified wound and the pus from the wound that's petrified. A foot in a cowboy boot that we've identified from the J. Leddy Boot Company that was made in the early 50s. We took this to the local hospital and did a CAT scan. We could see the broken bones down in the boot. And, of course, normally when they do a CAT scan, they got a name they put on the pictures. It came back, unfortunate cowboy. We prefer to call him the limestone cowboy. But he's not millions of years old. So, what we see in the geologic processes are rapid and continuous, indicated by the jellyfish and the DNA from the dinosaurs, from the polystrate fossils, ferns, from the continuous layers, one after the other, indicated by the ephemeral markings between the layers, the coal, oil, petrified boots. Where's the time? It must take a long time. What we see indicates exactly the opposite. Now, why? Radiometric dating is not a real good answer. Geologic formations are rapid and continuous. And so that's why I say, I don't think it looks old at all. I think it looks flooded. And I think their conclusion about Mars, I'm not sure how the water got there or what, but I know what it looks like, and they do too, and acknowledge it. Now, what we've done so far this evening is to show you why the evidence that is negative to the young Earth, that's supposed to be indications of an old Earth, doesn't say what they say it says. In fact, if anything, it says the opposite. There are lots of reasons that we can give for the young Earth that we don't have time to look at this evening. If you want that lecture, we're going to have more time. Evolutionists are not the only ones that have problems with time. But here's Stanfield in his book. He's the anti-creationist. He says, here are lots of indications of a young Earth. And I'm not going to take time to look at these, which I sometimes at least hit the high points out. Let's go down to the bottom, to the last one. We'll look at the one that he mentions. And we've talked a little bit about population dynamics earlier when we were talking about the flood, but the U.S. growth rate, population growth rate, is recently 0.81%, less than 1%. It's much more than that in most of the world. That's ridiculously slow. But let's use that in order to test the concept. Not 8.1. Let's cut that in half virtually, and obviously I'm playing with the numbers here. 4.6%, less than half a percent for 4,500 years, which is the time since the flood. Eight people from the flood to now. How many would we have at this very slow growth rate? About 7 billion, which is about what we got. Okay, that's a very conservative way to get to where we are. That works. Let's compare that with the evolutionist idea and using the same very slow growth rate, 200,000 years instead of 4,500 years. Well, 200,000 years is a drop in the bucket for most evolutionists. Man's been here a couple of million years at least, so 200,000, this is very conservative. Likewise, how many people would you have? 4.312 times 10 to the 398th. Now, if you know anything about scientific notation, you know that's stupid. That's just wrong, ridiculously wrong. To give an idea of how much, 10 to the 398th, they're 10 to the 65th electrons in the galaxy. And we're talking about 10 to the 398th? Well, galaxy limits it. Let's take it to the universe. To go from the galaxy to the universe, it's all the way to 10 to the 80th. But you're talking about 10 to the 398th? That's just nuts. This is just about right. Their view is nuts. Now, this is the way you do science. You test it. You see how it works. Theirs just is nuts, and it won't work. Well, I think that's good evidence. Like the other factors that we don't have to, we have a whole lot more to indicate the Earth young, and it's better evidence. So that, as we evaluate with our model comparison, we have lots of good evidence compared to the evidence of the evolutionist, which is not good evidence. In fact, many instances indicates the opposite. We could summarize saying we have more and better, and they have fewer and not so good. The best scientific conclusion to the question, how old is the Earth, is that it is young. I think it is a scientific conclusion to say it is thousands of years old, not billions. Drawing a finer line than that from science is often difficult, but that's enough to tell us that the evolutionists are not telling us the truth about the time. It's not a scientific conclusion. It's a religious conclusion, like somebody looking at the Bible and seeing something they don't like. Thousands, not billions, is the scientific answer. That means that this Earth hadn't been here very long. It hadn't been here for billions of years, which gives comfort to those who think maybe I don't have to worry about the judgment. The book that describes the beginning said it wasn't very long ago, and that's what science indicates, and it also says it's not going to be here very long. It's coming to an end, and you need to be ready. There is a great day coming. Now, maybe that doesn't sound too threatening if it's been here for billions of years, but that's not the case. The best science says otherwise, and certainly the Bible does. You need to be ready. It's coming soon, maybe today. And that has the force of reality when we understand it hasn't been here that long. The Bible described the beginning, it describes the end. If you're here and haven't rendered obedience to the gospel this evening, we want to encourage you to do that as we stand and sing, encouraging you to respond.